now have an early break for morning tea. Afternoon tea. Gee, you guys are awake, aren't you? So I'm going to adjourn
spell
now.
Spell that by your christening.
2:34. We'll come back in 20 minutes' time. 2:54. Resume the hearing, and the next submitter on our list is Stuart Browning. Good afternoon and welcome. We've read the original submission. Thank you very much for putting that in. You don't need to reread that to us, but you're very welcome to speak to it or highlight key points for us.
Good afternoon. I'm pleased to present to you as an individual farmer. I manage a 374 hectare dry stock farm near the Waituna Lagoon, and as a result, we have experience with dealing with water quality issues. Starting before my tenure as manager, my farm owners are planting the banks of Currens Creek, which flows through our farm to the Waituna Lagoon and other areas of the farm. Recreating native plantings enhances the appearance of the farm, provides shelter for stock, as well as the environmental effects of the riparian plantings. We've built a feed pad for wintering stock, and when it is fully developed, it's likely we will not have any winter crops. The construction of the pad makes economical as well as animal welfare and environmental sense. To address my submissions, I heard your comments regarding the physiographic zones, but the Ashes pit has a small lignite zone around it, but the Waituna pit, which is subdivided off our farm, is essentially outside the zone, as is shown on the map which I provided you. And the original pit, which is now a pond, is a considerable distance outside the zone. I'd not be surprised to find that buried in the report supporting the concept of physiographic zones, that there is a justification, but in this case, it lacks logic. In seeing this apparent anomaly in a very small area, it can be expected there are more, and my question is it reasonable for landowners to spend a considerable sum of money to correct council's errors? Rule 15, I note and agree with the changes recommended in the Section 42A report. Rule 23, while there are changes recommended in the Section 42 report, it appears there is an assumption that bigger is bad. The recommended changes allow two-thirds of a 75 hectare farm to be intensively winter grazed, but only 10% of a 500 hectare farm. There's no logic than that I can see. As the plan is currently written, consents will be needed for next winter. Decisions for this are being made now, and actual preparation work will start in November and October. So unless you rush the final decision-making phase, there will be an overlap when landowners are needing to apply for a consent, but the consent is not possible because no one will know what the rules are. Well, the Section 42 report recommends the deletion of BVI, and I'm neutral regarding the change. There are various rules containing setbacks from waterways. In my opinion, they lack detail on how the distance is measured. For example, will laying a tape on the ground be acceptable? Will an imaginary straight line be used, that is, a vertical line from the edge of the bed and then a horizontal line for the setback? Does the slope of the bank form part of the slope angle? Rule 35. My original submission remains unaddressed. We do not plan to use our feed pad for winter stock, subject to the definition of winter stock, and as the rule is written, I'd vigorously argue that the rule doesn't apply as we're not farming adult cattle. We mostly winter rising one-year-old stock and a small number of no more than 100 rising two-year-olds. I support the deletion of clause 3BII. Regarding rule 38, I support the deletion of the clause DIV for the reasons of my submission. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, that's very clear. Let's see if we have any questions for you. Morris?
Well, thank you. Yes, on that rule 38, how will
How will farmers tell when the ground temperature is more than 5 degrees and less than field capacity?
In my case, I use the EES Beacon website.
Okay.
I also have a probe thermometer, which I'm able to measure the soil temperatures. And generally speaking, if you're walking across the paddock, you know whether or not the ground is saturated.
So from an enforcement point of view, it's a little bit difficult doing that, using the EES website or the walking across the paddock.
I think even at the moment, you would probably ignore the EES website at your peril for enforcement reasons. If it's noted as red and there's no irrigation and you're irrigating, you'd have to have it would be reasonable to expect that it's up to you then to prove that you're on the right.
Yes.
And I see no reason to expect that to change.
Okay, now that's useful. Two others. You say that feedlots only refer to cattle and deer and that sheep on feedlots are not included. Do you think that sheep should be included and deer as well? The point you raise is a good one, and there is a bit of an anomaly there, and we have to sort that out. But do you think sheep should be included?
If they don't express any effluent, no, they don't need to be.
Because we've had some deer farmers here today who have cattle or deer inside, but they don't produce much in the way of effluent, they say.
Well, again, the same thing applies. If they don't express effluent, why worry about them? And if they're living, I can't imagine they don't.
Okay, and the other thing is about management plans. You say that it should be done every 5 years or when there are changes. Can you elaborate a bit on what you think the purpose of the management plan should be and who's best to prepare and monitor these?
In my case, I think it has, in a lot of other cases, it would be a case of a combination between an outside consultant, the owner, and the manager or the person operating the farm, because the owner would be, he's the person who, in my case, sets the strategic direction, which influences what happens going forward. I manage the day-to-day stuff, so exactly that's the bit that it's in my, of which I have full control of. I stated in my case that my farm owner sets the management plan and I implement it and make it work. So therefore I have a part to play in it, and invariably because of how regional council staff want to operate, you're invariably going to have a consultant write it. Because it's almost impossible to get a consent without having a consultant prepare it.
For a management plan, you mean?
Yep. So I don't see those rules being any different.
Do you think it would be possible to create one without having to have external help?
That would be literally down to the offices of the regional council. Because everybody then would write one in a completely different way.
So the Appendix N management plan that's in there at the moment, have you had a good look at that to see whether or not you could do that without a consultant?
I read through it and go, it's easier to get a consultant in and they can use the cut and paste method.
Is that a good thing though?
No. Consents are issued on a cut and paste basis, so I see no reason why the management plans won't be and everything else won't be.
But it's not desirable if they are.
It's the reality of how it is.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't need to be.
Do we have a question?
Yeah. Okay, thanks very much. No, that's good.
Edward.
Oh, yes. You're aware, are you, that the calendar date's been removed from Rule 38, or suggest recommendation by the Section 42?
I didn't see that when I was looking at the weekend, but I accept that.
Well, it's recommended, and that's something for us to consider. So just thought I'd let you know that. You said you had a feed pad, not a wintering pad, on you.
Well, again, as per the discussions in the Section 42A report, is that there's kind of a variation of a theme about what's a wintering pad and what's a feed pad. And I mean, construction-wise, it's probably not a lot of difference, but it's a terminology thing. And I mean, I think personally that they're all exactly the same.
Is yours concrete based? Or?
partially. We feed on concrete, but they actually rest on wood chips, on shingle, on drainage.
And you don't grow crops here, it's silage or?
Well, it's on a wintering / feed pad, it's all grass silage. Mm.
Thank you.
That's very clear, thank you, I have no questions.
Just come back to the feed pad, you've got a drainage system, do you actually collect any effluent from that?
We've got a 7.2 million litre effluent pond. And part of our plan is then to be able to put our nutrient back out on the paddocks we're harvesting grass from, so that we're returning nutrients. And we've had a pre-build and a post-build nutrient plan developed, so we know what the effect is.
Thank you for that one. The appendix N, if I take from your comments, you're actually suggesting that the ownership of the plan is actually very important.
Yes.
Against a cut and paste methodology that you're suggesting. So I'd be interested to know, is there any other way that we can actually get ownership of the plan, the people that actually are operating the properties better?
Right now I don't know. I think that I would be in the middle of the great unwashed, which was kind of ambivalent towards them, and go, we try, in my case, I know that we try and do the right thing for environment, which happens to be the right thing economically most of the time. So it's a bit like a lot of the other plans that are drawn up, is they don't actually add anything bar for a paper trail.
So the expectation is that the management plan is something that is looked at, updated, checked with yourself improving all the time.
Yeah.
And if we can, and that's why I think there's been quite a discussion around who actually fills it in, who actually gets the information to fill it in, is actually quite important. If you fill it in, you understand what's in the plan, and you know, so those things are actually pretty important.
But I mean, the question is that, put it another way, is it going to be a case that these farm management plans are drawn up and put along the way with the file with the health and safety plan and all the other plans that are drawn up to gather dust in the cupboard? That is, they're not used. I mean, what's going to happen is a good farm management plan will highlight areas, and a lot of people will act on them and trend towards them, which is why I don't think they need to be renewed that often, because farms generally don't change, they trend. You move, you don't suddenly decide one day you're going to change from one style of farming to another style, you trend towards it. And that's why they don't need to be updated very often. But and it's because they don't need to be renewed and updated very often, they don't need to be referred to very often, because you kind of have an idea in your head. It's a bit like, you know where you want to be in 5 years' time.
And my last question is around Rule 23. You've made some suggestions there and shown the differences of different size properties. Do you have any recommendation to us around what could be used across all farm sizes?
Well, the percentage is the easy option, but that doesn't necessarily properly reflect it either. Putting a limit on, as if you're a cynic, would be as to say that getting a consent is merely to ensure that an officer of the regional council remains or creates a job for themselves. So in setting a limit, if you want to set a limit, I would suspect that you're probably going to tend towards a percentage with a total limit. So that you may go for, you could have 15% or 20% of your farm, whichever is considered to be reasonable in a pasture or renewal rotation. And that science seems to be moving a bit as to how often farmers should create new pasture relative to meet pre-production. So and that figure will fall somewhere between 10 and 20%. Past that, then there's people who are invariably operating at their whole business model is around large-scale winter grazing, probably of dairy cows. and those dairy cows have to eat something over the winter. And I think it would be, and this is something we brought up in the discussions with, through the Waitunga Lagoon stuff, is shipping those cows off somewhere else doesn't actually fix the problem, if there's a problem. All it does is shift the problem to somebody else. And that doesn't matter whether it's catchment or region. It just goes, they move off. So if you, and when we come time to do the FMUs, that if there's limit setting for losses made, then you run the risk of that attitude being taken further, and that is that to get your nutrient losses down, you shift the problem to somebody else, and it doesn't actually fix a problem anywhere. All it's doing is shuffling it around.
Which actually brings up the discussion of unintended consequences. You try to fix one thing and you create two other more problems. So.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, no, thank you for that.
And I have no further questions.
Thank you very much.